Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Neil Gaiman, one of the world's most beloved fantasy authors, has won the Hugo and Bram Stoker Awards and the Newbery Medal. His eclectic catalog includes The Sandman, Stardust, American Gods, Coraline, and The Graveyard Book. And now he's written his first novel for adults in 8 years. In the ocean at the end of the lane, a seven-year-old boy lives down the lane from the Hemstocks, three generations of women who run a farm in rural England. When supernatural things start to occur, the youngster realizes that the Hemstocks are not what they seem and are the only ones who can help. It is a bewitching and harrowing tale of mystery and survival and memory and magic, which makes the impossible all too real. Before a crowd of 1,500 in Saratoga Springs, it's a great pleasure to welcome Neil Gaiman to The Book Show.
I'm now in the remarkable position of being everything I ever wanted to be and having done pretty much everything I ever wanted to do, which is a pretty odd thing to happen. You know, I'm starting to feel like I'm an episode of The Twilight Zone. And obviously the next thing that happens is I wake up in the gutter as a wino. And I go, no, I have a New York Times best-selling book. I wrote The Sandman, damn it, I want Doctor Who. And they'll be going, and they'll be going, no, you're a wino. You just imagine this. You've been walking around now for weeks. You think you're married to a rock star. And it's, I don't know. So that's how it feels right now.
So at what point did it change for you? Was it very gradual? Or
it's been very gradual. It's you know, that thing where you boil a frog so slowly that he's just sitting there thinking he's having a bath. No, I don't know. I started out as a journalist and didn't really want to be a journalist, but wanted to be a journalist for everything that I could learn being a journalist, and was very happy to forsake journalism for comics in, you know, the late 80s, when you didn't write comics for the money or the glory, because there was no money. And absolutely no glory. And then slowly the world changed, and by the time I'd been doing this for a couple of years, I remember having a conversation with somebody who turned out to be the literary editor of the Daily Telegraph at a Christmas party. And he said, so what do you do? And I said, well, I write comics. And he looked as if I just told him that I do bad things to corpses. And he couldn't exactly just leave, so he said, well, what kind of comics? I said, well, I'm doing a thing called Sandman. I did a book called Violent Cases. I think at the time I was just working on Signal to Noise. He said, hang on, you're Neil Gaiman. And I said, yes. He said, well, I've heard of you. You don't write comics. You write graphic novels. And I felt a lot like a hooker who'd just been told she was a lady of the evening. So comics, I carried on doing that until about 96, and when I finished Sandman, and I had lots of other things that I'd wanted to do that I couldn't do while I was doing Sandman. So then I started out in novels, and that was just small, you know. Neverwhere came out and didn't make any bestseller lists. And Stardust came out and didn't make any bestseller lists, and Smoke and Mirrors came out, this short story collection, and coincidentally made no bestseller lists. But what was weird was that week in and week out, and month in and month out, people continued buying the books. And I remember when I was about to do my next book, and it was time for my publisher to pay me money for what turned out to be American Gods, they paid me quite a lot of money. And I got a phone call from an editor at another publishing house who was a friend of mine. And he said, Neil, you're going to think I'm an idiot, but they paid you a lot of money. And I said, yes. And he said, but I see your sales figures, and you, how can you be worth that money? And I said, why don't you go and look? Don't look at what I sell on my first week. Go and look at what I sell week in and week out. And he phoned me back 2 days later, and he said, you're a proper author. And I said, yes, I apparently I am. And so then American Gods came out. And by the time that American Gods had finished coming out, I was actually a proper author. It actually did make the lower reaches of the top 10 of the New York Times list for a week. And then it won me the Hugo and the Nebula and all of these awards. So at that point, I became a little-known children's author. And that was fun, with Coraline and with The Wolves in the Walls. And then, I don't know, things sort of... It was like I was a big fish in a lot of very small puddles. And then gradually the water level in all of those puddles was slowly rising while we weren't looking. Now I'm this ridiculous fish who gets to be... to completely destroy the metaphor, absolutely amphibian in that I can... I'm allowed to move from medium to medium. I'm allowed to move from kind of book to kind of book. And that is the thing that I treasure most.
The new book, as I mentioned, is The Ocean at the End of the Wane. And it's one of the most beautiful novels I've ever read. It's absolutely gorgeous. And the thing that struck me, and I'm wondering, because there are sentences in here that are just perfect. Because you have that background in comics, does that sharpen the writing?
Yeah, I mean, what I learned in comics, which I treasure to this day, more than anything else, was I learned economy. You only have a certain amount. You can probably comfortably fit about 6 or 7 panels on a page before a page looks really cramped. You can probably fit maybe a couple of word balloons in each of those panels. But you can't put more than about 30 words in any panel. So you really learn compression even more than you learn working on Twitter. You learn to squeeze things and go, okay, what am I trying to say and how am I trying to say it? But I think actually the skills involved in writing comics are very different to prose skills. When I finished writing Sandman, and the next thing I did really was the Neverwhere novel, I found it very difficult because I kept wanting to describe things in the way that I was used to describing things, which was describing them to an artist who was going to draw them. So I would put all the information, everything that an artist would need to draw, I would be putting in Neverwhere. And I had to sort of unlearn that. Not that that was a literary technique, but I had to remember that you can describe things best in prose by just, it's just a little pencil line here and a little bit of shading over there, and you can leave things to people's imaginations. There are things you don't have to describe, or if you do describe them, you only have to put in 1 or 2 beautiful little salient details and people's minds will fill in the rest.
So much of the descriptors of this book and the press that I have read so far has talked about it being an accidental book for you somewhat, of becoming a novel accidentally.
Well, my wife is a musician named Amanda Palmer. And last year, the beginning of the year, she went to Australia for 4 months to make an album, to rehearse the band, to finish the songs, to record the album. I missed her, and I missed her a lot. And she wasn't just making the album. That would have been fine, because we would have just Skyped and chatted and emailed and phoned. She really was making the album. She was head down. There wasn't really room for anything else in her life, including me. So I was off sort of suddenly missing her for the first time in 5 years. We'd been together, or we'd been in constant communication. And so I started writing a short story for her. She doesn't really like fantasy very much. But she likes me. And she likes honesty. And she likes feelings. I don't normally do feelings, because I'm English. And male. But I thought, I'll write her a short story. And it'll be about a sort of 7-year-old Neil. the family won't be my family, the actual events won't be real things that happened, but it'll be looking out at the world from pretty much a seven-year-old me. That was what I started out to do. And I took a anecdote that my father had told me a few years ago. I took a weird little family who had lived in my head since I was 9 or 10. And I put them together and I started my book. I didn't start my book, I started my story. And then I kept writing it. And after a week or two, I thought, it's not a short story. It's a novelette. They come in around 10,000 words. It's obviously a novelette. And so I carried on for another week or so. And I thought, well, it's a novella. And then I carried on for another few days. And then I sent an email off to my editor, Jennifer Brell. And I said, Jennifer, I'm apparently writing a novella. I know they're impossible to publish, and I have no idea what we'll do with it when it's done, but just early warning, there is a novella, it's being written. And I finished this thing that I thought was a novella, and Amanda came back just as I was finishing, she came back from Australia, and we met in Dallas, Texas, where she was mixing the album, and I would go off to a coffee shop every day, and I would type up the book and start doing my initial sort of second draft on the manuscript. And I typed up the book, and I'd read it to her every night when she got back jet-lagged and exhausted from mixing her album. And I would read her what I'd typed up that day until she fell asleep. And then the next morning, when she woke up, I'd say, where do you remember up to? And she would say, Letty had just turned up carrying the bucket. I go, good. And I go back a bit earlier and keep reading. But when I finished typing it, I did a word count, because you can do that. And I sent off a very, very surprised email to my editors saying, I wrote a novel. So it was absolutely an accidental novel. And I don't think I ever would have had, I guess, the chutzpah to go, I'm going to write a novel starring a seven-year-old and me, and it's going to be set in the world that I grew up in and in that landscape, because I wouldn't have thought that. I was planning, I meant to write a great big adventure novel instead and never actually wrote it. I wrote that.
The dedication to the book for Amanda, who wanted to know. So given her love, quote-unquote, of fantasy, what was the reaction?
She loved it. She loved the book. And I thought, good, my work here is done. It was really fun. She was my audience. I'd never done that before. I'd never actually gone, I'm writing a book really for one person. And I wrote my book for one person. And I was very happy. And I spent several months playing with it, tidying it, tightening it, just getting everything to work exactly like I wanted. And then I gave it to my editors, and they said, this is wonderful. I sent it to a few friends, and they were saying things like, this is the best thing you've ever done. And I went, oh. How odd. And then, you know, it wasn't really until the early advance reading copies of Ocean at the End of the Lane started going out, and people that I didn't know and who had no cause at all to be nice to me started saying in print that it was the best thing I'd ever done, or that they cried a lot. Somehow I wound up writing about their childhoods too, that I realized that I had accidentally done something very clever. And I think I would probably be more big-headed and insufferable about it if I had any clue how I'd done it or any idea how to do it again. So I'm just going, okay, did that. That's wonderful.
We use the word accidental, but was there a conscious moment where you said, because you were writing it for one particular person, your wife, and that person is an adult, that this would not be geared toward children?
About three quarters of the way through the book, I started puzzling over who it was for. And I started thinking a lot about who it was for. And in the margins, because I was handwriting this, I would write little notes to myself that were ideas and ponderings about things. I remember actually discovering while I was typing it out a large circled note to myself in a margin that just said, in adult books you can leave in the boring bits. It is true. I was giving a lecture in Chicago. I'd been invited to give this thing called the Zena Sutherland Lecture. Given that all I was thinking about at the time was the oddness of the ocean at the end of the lane, which I think I just finished at the point where I had to write my lecture. The lecture was absolutely all about whether or not, really, it was just all about what's appropriate for children. Is childhood appropriate for children? When I was, I was eight, and I was walking home from school, and I met some kids from a rougher, tougher school, and they told me a dirty joke with a rude word in it. And they made me promise not to tell anybody. So, of course, the next morning at my school, I told that rude joke that I didn't actually understand, but I felt it made me sort of seem sophisticated. And I told it to three other boys. And at lunchtime, I was called in to... Actually, it wasn't lunchtime that day. Lunchtime the following day, I was called in to the headmistress's office. And she said, Neil, tell me about four-letter words. And I had never heard that expression before, so... But, you know, that was the kind of thing that English teachers and teachers generally would ask you. So I'm going, well, bath, them... Bats, cats, dogs. I'd realized you could take three-letter words and add an S to it. And I remember her telling me to shut up, which was the first time a teacher had actually said, shut up. And I was sent home from school early. And that night, my mother came home very, very late, and she'd been called in for a meeting. And she explained that one of the boys that I told the dirty joke to had told his mother, who had been so offended that a word so incredibly rude, I cannot tell you what it was, but it rhymed with duck, had been used, that this child had been pulled out of school and taken away from that school and was never going to be returned. And it was only because the school, which was a very small private school, had lost one set of school fees that I was not being expelled, I was told. And I love looking back on that. I go, well, that's not really a story you'd ever tell an eight-year-old. It's a story that eight-year-olds go through. It's about weirdness and helplessness and not quite understanding the adult world. So the ocean at the end of the lane for me was all about... It's not really a book for kids. Kids don't need to be told what it's like to be kids. They're there. Mm-hmm. That's where they live. Whereas adults... who have completely forgotten what it's like to be kids and who also know what it's like to be an adult and know the strange gulfs of memory, they were the people I wrote the book for.
And that exploration of memory is beautiful and it's fascinating because I guess we all have that, don't we, where there's these things that we can just think of that are so crystal clear. And then we're told from somebody else about something that happened that we have no recollection of at all.
Memory is such a deceiver, and it's so dangerous. You know, you wander back through memory at your own risk. And it's also, of course, one of those really weird things because sometimes there weren't people around who remember the same things as you, and sometimes there were people... experiencing almost the same things as you with memories running on a parallel track that are not yours. It can be really weird when you have, you know, two kids a couple of years apart and one of them had a miserable childhood and one of them had a ridiculously happy childhood and they were going through the same places and then they talk as adults and you have that sort of oddness. In the case of Ocean at the End of the Lane, it wasn't just memory, but I was fascinated while I wrote it at how many weird things that I'd completely forgotten came back to haunt me. I mean, things I didn't put in the book. There's a lot of food in the book, and it's nice food.
Comfort food.
It is comfort food. It is food as love. And of course, I didn't put in the opposite of that, which is food as punishment. The kinds of things. I was raised in England at a time when you were, particularly at school, you had to clean your plate. A plate of food was put in front of you. You could not leave the table until all that food was gone. There were children starving in China. You could never figure out what the one had to do with the other. Especially when adults rejected summarily your suggestion that perhaps the food you didn't want could be sent to these children who were starving in China, thus solving both problems. But I just, I remember Wednesdays at my school was nightmarish because it was this sad little salad of a crispy leaf and a half of tomato and a large lump of pickled beetroot. And I would sit there slicing my pickled beetroot into paper-thin slices that I could put into my mouth and wash down with water without actually chewing. And this process took a long time. And in the end, there would just be me and one teacher glaring at me because she obviously wanted to go up to the staff room and have a cigarette, but she couldn't because I was just slicing this beetroot and washing it down.
I also found it interesting that when you refer to the characters, most of the time, it's by their full name, except for the narrator.
There's more than just the narrator. He doesn't have a name. But then his mother is referred to as his mother, and his father is his father, and his sister is his sister. And occasionally you'll get other people, adults in the plot, and they are described by their function because he doesn't know their name. You know, the policeman is the policeman. But then you have characters who have to have their full names. My favorite of which is Ursula Monckton. I Googled it after I'd, you know, sort of that thing where you go, I think I'm going to call her Ursula Monckton. And then you hit Google because you do not want a real Ursula Monckton. And you are hoping against hope. There's nothing. And there was nothing. And I was thrilled. It was like, good. But the fun about Ursula Monckton as well, I think one reason why she has both names is Mary Poppins has both names always. She's never referred to as Mary in the books. She's always Mary Poppins. I liked the idea that Ursula Monckton was a sort of the flip side of Mary Poppins, this sort of, you know, Mary Poppins comes into your life with a spoonful of sugar, and I don't know what's in Ursula Monckton's spoon, but it's not sugar.
Yeah.
Sort of a spoonful of cyanide, or spoonful of nightmares.
And was it conscious not to name the narrator?
Yeah, it was very conscious. There was, in the very first draft in handwriting, he got referred to once by name or addressed once by name by Ursula. But then at the point where I realized I got through the entire book only naming him once, I thought, you know, I'll lose that. You know, we don't, generally speaking, walk around thinking of ourselves as names. We think of ourselves as ourselves. I don't walk around going, I am Neil. Or even, I am Neil Gaiman. Look what I'm doing in my Neil Gaiman way. It's just I. I mean, that's names, you know. Names, especially if you've been signing your name a lot, they get even less likely. I look down, I am Nell Gurgle.
The new novel is The Ocean at the End of the Lane. It is published by Morrow. Neil Gaiman, thank you so much for being with us. Such a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you very much for having me, Joe.
Thank you so much for listening. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can also listen again and find this or past book shows at wamc.org. This has been an off-the-shelf edition of The Book Show in partnership with Northshire Books in Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York, northshire.com. For more information, Sarah LaDuke produced our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.